For the rest of the hour, a look at the biology and chemistry going on in our kitchen. And you know there is a lot of it going on, and I, to my way of thinking, it's just fascinating stuff, and I love talking about it, and that's why I'm happy to bring on a couple of scientists and authors who have written about this extensively. For example, nearly 20 years ago, Harold McGee wrote On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, and the book forever married science to the culinary arts and gave hundreds of chefs and budding chefs, people like me, lots of new ways to think about food and the way it is prepared. And in the last 20 years, you know, a lot of it has changed. Our tastes have changed, and things that go into the kitchen and kinds of utensils we use and technologies and the way we think about food has changed. And so Mr. McGee has just unveiled version 2 of On Food and Cooking, updating it to reflect changes in the way we eat, the foods we have access to. Oh, 20 years ago, who talked about balsamic vinegar, right? Well, we had, now also we eat chocolate and coffee and seafood. These are just a few of the new topics he tackles in version 2. And joining me now to talk about his new book is Harold McGee, author of On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, just out by Scribner. Maybe you have his other book, The Curious Cook. He joins us from Stanford University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira.
Hi there. You really are not a scientist, are you?
No, I'm a writer.
A writer. Do you wear that badge?
Well, you know what? I think there are, of course, some disadvantages to not being a scientist or to not being a professionally trained chef. On the other hand, I think there are some advantages as well, because I don't take anything for granted, and I need to understand something before I'm sure that my readers can.
And you don't, and you're not locked into old dogma then, right?
That's right. That's right.
Give us some of the myths that you've been you've busted over the last 20 years about cooking and cooking chemistry.
Well, I'm not sure that I've busted them, but there are plenty of myths around that that deserve busting. And the one that is most persistent is the idea that searing meat seals in the juices. That's something I wrote about 20 years ago, and in fact, that myth had been busted maybe 50 years before I even got to it. And yet, you still read it in magazines and hear about it on TV shows.
All the time.
Yeah, if you heat a piece of meat at a very high temperature to begin with, you're somehow cauterizing the outside surface and preventing any of the juices from coming out, and that guarantees you a juicy piece of meat at the end. The moment you ask a chef whether that's really true and does it mean that it's impossible to overcook a piece of meat, of course he or she knows that's not true, but it just sounds so nice and pleasant and reassuring that I think we're probably stuck with it.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking about the science of cooking this hour. So have you been lambasted? I guess that's a good word when you talk about cooking for this heretical view about searing meat.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is that you might think that's an old cook's tale, but it's actually an old chemist's tale. Mm-hmm. Before the middle of the 19th century, people had a very different way of thinking about cooking meat, and they would kind of brown it at the very end just to give it a nice color and flavor. And then along came a German chemist by the name of Justus Liebig, who had lots of theories but didn't seem to do very many experiments. And so he published a book called Researches on the Chemistry of Food. And it's very interesting. It seemed that cooks at the time were really hungry for a kind of rational explanation for things. And this was really the first one that they'd been offered. And so there are books that came out in various editions. Pre-Liebig, they had the old-fashioned way of cooking meat. Post-Liebig, just 5 or 10 years later, they'd switched completely. So he had a huge influence.
Very interesting. We're talking with author Harold McGee, who wrote On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, following up on his book on The Curious Cook. We're also going to have to take a short break, but we're going to also, when we come back from the break, bring on Richard Zehr. Remember, we've had Richard Zehr on. Dr. Zehr has been on before talking about bubbles. He's an expert on bubbles, writes about champagne. Some interesting research he talked about how do you save an open bottle of champagne. This is surprising. And about fizz and what goes on inside a glass of beer. So our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, if you'd like to get in on a conversation. You also talk about chocolate. in a lot of chocolate going on in your book.
That's right. That's something that, of course, people ate chocolate 20 years ago. They ate lots of chocolate, but they mostly just ate it. They didn't work with it. They didn't cook with it to the extent that they do now. They didn't make their own chocolates, and we didn't have the tremendous range that we have now of different kinds of chocolate. You go into the store now, and you see chocolates labeled 50%, 62%, 70%. Knowing what all that stuff means takes a little research.
All right, we'll come back and talk lots more with Harold McGee and bring on Dr. Zier. And your questions, 1-800-989-8255. I know everybody wants to talk about the chemistry of cooking. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the science, chemistry, biology of cooking with my guest, Doc Harold McGee, who's author of the newly revised book on food and cooking, the science and lore of the kitchen. I want to now bring on to join us Richard Zier. He is the Marguerite Blake Wilbur Professor in Natural Science at Stanford University. Thanks for coming back, Dr. Zier.
It's good to hear your voice again.
Good to hear you. Tell us about champagne. Champagne's big this time of the year. What makes champagne? You study bubbles, and I have so much to talk about the bubbles. Let's talk about champagne, though. What makes gives champagne its distinctive bubbly taste and its consistency?
Well, there's a whole fermentation process that one goes through to produce it, and this is quite involved and detailed, in which you have to later on add sugar to the bottle after you've let it sit for a while. And actually freeze its top and take things off and get it so it's carbonated again. It's a fermentation process,
right?
But that extra sugar gives it, through the action of yeast, the bubbles, which some of us really enjoy a great deal. Did you know, for example, that in a simple glass of champagne, that if you leave it alone long enough, it'll give off something like 1 million or 2 million bubbles?
Wow. No, I didn't know that. Well, what about the what? I understand, though, there's an interaction between if you have lipstick and you drink something out of the glass, the lipstick interacts with the champagne. Is that correct?
Well, anything like any greasy thing like potato chips or French fries or lipstick will actually break up the bubbles. So will leaving too much soap in a glass. And people have, I think, experienced that, particularly when they've ordered a beer and someone's washed the glass but forgot to wash out the soap. And it's not pleasant.
Why is it when you throw it, speaking of beer, why is it, you know, if you want to get the head to come back, you'll see bartenders throw some salt into it sometimes and the bubbles start coming back.
The bubbles themselves form on little places, little nooks and crannies, or on fibers that have been left in the glass that's been wiped clean with a towel or a paper towel or some type of rag. These act like little bubble guns. Mm-hmm. If you look at the bubbles forming in anything, let's take water, for example. You bring water to a boil. Where are the bubbles in the water, in the pan of water that's brought to a boil? They're not all over the place. It is after it starts to boil, but initially, where are they? They're always on the sides of the pan, and if you look very carefully, they're on scratches and nicks and other irregularities. And why is that? Because water loves itself. It loves itself so much that it crushes bubbles. It won't let bubbles form in water all by itself. Mm-hmm. So the bubbles need to hide, be sequestered, protect themselves until they get large enough so they can lift off and then drift upwards.
Interesting. Harold McGee, you talk a lot in your new book about seafood. And why do you, you know, devote so much time in seafood this time where you hadn't in your last book?
Well, because I've learned a lot and because we eat more of it and it's become more prominent in our diet, actually speaking, and because it's thought that the fats that are special to seafoods are especially healthful for us. But I became fascinated just by the diversity of animals and plants as well, algae and seaweeds and so on, that human beings have used and continue to use. And they're real distinctive properties. You know, these things all evolved in a much colder environment than land animals. And so their biochemistry and the microbes that live on them and that spoil them also operate at very low temperatures. And that's why, for example, where a piece of meat can sit in your refrigerator and be useful for, you know, a week or so, fish spoils much more rapidly, and you can actually make it keep much better simply by putting it on a bed of ice in the refrigerator, because those extra 10 or 15 degrees of coldness make a tremendous difference in slowing down the enzymes and bacteria and slowing down the spoilage.
So you should really store fish on ice then?
Yes, but not
freeze it. This is right on the ice, but not freeze it.
Exactly, yeah. And even going to the trouble, for example, of taking a cooler with you to the supermarket in the car and then putting the fish, having the fishmonger put the fish on ice in the store and then put it in the cooler on the way back, because, you know, driving half an hour on a hot summer day can make a difference too.
1-800-999.
May I talk about keeping your cool for a moment? Because Harold McGee and I did some experiments about that in terms of champagne.
Sure.
And cool. And what we're referring to is how to keep a champagne bottle from going flat after you've opened it. Now, my friends in France tell me that there's no problem. You just drink it, so you don't have any need to worry about this. But some of us do. And we found that the best thing you can do to keep it with its effervescence is to keep it cold. It turns out that cold liquids dissolve gases much more than hot liquids. When you start to heat water or a liquid, you drive the gas out of it. So keeping it cold is the secret, we think, to keep it fizzing. So we did some other studies.
So you don't have to put the stopper or the cork back in or anything else in the bottle? You just leave it open in the refrigerator?
Well, that was another part of the experiment, because Dick's French friends said that the best way to keep a semi-finished bottle of champagne fresh was to put a silver spoon in the neck. And we thought that putting a cork in the neck would clearly do a much better job of keeping the carbon dioxide in the bottle. So we did a blind tasting. We got some friends together who were interested in this kind of science and did a blind tasting. Some bottles we opened freshly. Some bottles we left open overnight. Some bottles we emptied partway and then put a cork in the neck and let that sit overnight. And we were surprised to find with American sparkling wines, anyway, that some of the bottles that were left open or with a spoon in the neck actually did taste better than bottles that had been recorked.
It's interesting to think about how that could be happening. Wines actually age when you leave them out in the air. There's an oxidation process that goes on. And in a sparkling wine, the gases actually can be removing things from the wine and making it taste sweeter. Incidentally, that effect really happens in beer. If you taste the head on a beer, it's actually bitterer than the beer itself, because the froth has extracted some of the hops flavoring in the foam that sits on your beer.
I have noticed that. It's true.
And this process, which first sounds like, just, you know, child's play to play with bubbles, turns out to have commercial interests as well. The same thing, which is doing this froth flotation, is what people do to tired oil wells. They inject bubbles into them, foam into them, and recover oil that's hard to otherwise get out.
Interesting. Also, wasn't there a study about whether, you know, people have a nice bottle of red wine and they uncork it and they leave it out to breathe? Does that actually make the wine breathe? I mean, the neck is so small. I thought I had read a study that if you leave it open like that, it never breathes. You have to decant it or leave it out or pour it into a glass.
Yeah, it's true that the surface area of wine exposed to the air, if you just open the bottle, is tiny. But if you then take that bottle and pour it into another container, you aerate it very thoroughly and really can detectably change the flavor of the wine in a matter of minutes.
Wow. All right, let's go. A lot of people have questions. 1-800-989-8255. Mary in Norfolk, Virginia. Hi. Happy holiday to you.
Same to you. Great to hear your show. Very, very appropriate for the season. It reminds me of a story that my mother has told me several times of when she used to live in New York City back in the 30s and 40s. And her mother had given her a beautiful sterling silver pitcher. Well, they lived on a fifth floor walk-up, and there was a bar that was down the street that offered beer for 25 cents a pitcher. Well, somebody told them that if they put butter on the inside of the pitcher, that the beer would go ahead, and they would get more beer for their money. And that was what they did. And the bartender was like, why is there butter on the inside of this pitcher? And, you know, these gals were smart.
They worked.
For their money.
Wow. Well,
this is the same effect as with lipstick, which breaks up the foam.
So if you go into a bar, bring some butter with you these days, and you'll get a
carbs.
That's a great story, Mary. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you. Have a great holiday.
You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. You know what else is going on these days that then Charles Berquist and I, my producer, was talking about this? One of the great gifts that people are getting are these blow torches for I guess, browning creme brulee. Is there a right way to do that and a wrong way to do that? Besides not setting it afire.
Harold. Yeah. Well, no, torches are long overdue for a prominent place in the kitchen, I think. And,
yeah,
in fact, if you go to the Smithsonian and look at the Julia Child's kitchen has been reassembled at the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, you can see that she had a very serious torch, you know, with a tank and everything.
No kidding.
So she was a real pioneer in that. And, of course, you know, basically cooking is adding heat to food. And torches are very good at adding a lot of heat very quickly and in a very focused and concentrated way. So it's a wonderful tool for browning things really exactly the way you want them at the last minute.
There's a picture of you in the New York Times recently showing you in your I guess it's your kitchen with a looks like a torch taken to a turkey. Is that right?
Yes. Well, you know, turkeys are a real challenge. And one of the challenges is to get a crisp skin. And a torch allows you to really kind of linger lovingly over every square inch of it, making sure that you can get it as crisp as you can. Actually, in the case of crisping turkey skin, though, I found that a heat gun, you know, the kind of thing you use for removing paint from walls, that works a little better because it's not quite so concentrated a source of heat. So it's better at desiccating.
So they'll be selling this in the food section now of Home Depot, the heat gun. And you also go to, you know, one of the biggest problems with a turkey is how do you get all the meat to cook at the same time? Some is done earlier than others, right?
That's right.
I know it's true in my house, and I'm trying to check the thermostats in the oven, and they seem to be okay, but it's not cooking uniformly.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, turkeys are very non-uniform pieces of food. In fact, there was a study done a few years ago where they took 128 turkeys of various weights and cooked them all in the same oven at the same temperature over the course of a few days. And what they found was that two turkeys that were 3 or 4 pounds different in weight could cook in exactly the same time. And conversely, two turkeys that were the same weight could take a half hour different times to finish. So there is clearly a lot of irregularity in the structure of turkeys and the way the air flows around and so on that makes it very hard to predict when exactly they're going to be done. So that's exactly the right thing to do, is to be checking all the time, especially in the breast meat, which is especially sensitive to overcooking, to make sure that you don't go past the perfect point.
Is it true that you put ice packs on your turkey parts?
Yes. I started out using, you know, these kind of blue ice packs for athletes suffering from aching muscles. I put those on the breast while the turkey sits out on the counter at room temperature for a couple of hours just before the roasting. And what that does is it allows the legs to warm up to something close to room temperature while the breast stays cold. And then when you put the turkey in the oven, the legs kind of have a head start on heating up, and so they end up getting hotter than the breasts do, and that's what you want to have happen. The leg meat just needs more cooking than the breast meat does.
We're talking about the science and chemistry of cooking this hour with Harold McGee and Richard Zehr on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Lots of people with questions. Let's see if we can help out holiday folks like Roland in St. Louis. Hi, Roland.
How are you doing, Ira?
Hi, how are you?
Very good. I have an old family eggnog recipe, and I wanted to ask your guests a little bit about it. What we do is we take a quarter pint of dark rum, pint of bourbon, 6 eggs, 2 cups of sugar, superfine sugar, and 2 pints of whipping cream. And we put the booze and the sugar together 2 days in advance. And we use raw eggs and, you know, beat the yolks, fold in the bourbon mix, and then you beat the egg whites till they're stiff. And then you add the, beat the whipped cream until it's stiff, and you fold it all in together. I don't know. I guess it's an old family type thing, but you always do the egg whites before you do the cream? Would there be a reason for that?
I think if there's a reason, and I'm not exactly sure, I'd need to do the experiment both ways and see what happened. But my guess is that the whipped egg whites are simply more stable than whipped cream is. And so since it's going to have to wait a while until you finish the next step, it's going to remain stable longer.
Well, yeah,
that's my guess.
Pretty good.
Oh, whoa. Sounded good. It's very low caloric, I can hear from that. Have a happy holiday.
You too. Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Emily in Forest Grove, Oregon. Hi, Emily.
Hi, happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
I have an idea for the previous caller. Maybe the fat on the beaters would mess up beating the egg whites, and so maybe you don't have to clean the beaters if you do the eggs first.
Ah, I like that explanation, yes.
He's writing it down for the next edition.
I'm a lazy cook, and that makes a lot of sense.
Wow.
But my question is about bread. I make a lot of bread myself, usually whole wheat. And the one thing that I can never get is the big open holes, like a nice French bread has from, you know, my favorite bakery. They got these big open holes in the bread, and I'm wondering, is it because I'm using too much whole wheat? Like sometimes they use half white. I've tried a lot of things, but I always get a nice bread, but never big holes.
Uh-huh. Well, there are two things that can help you get those big holes. One is to make sure that the dough is a relatively wet one, so it's almost too wet, too sloppy to handle, almost too wet to knead. And it seems as though that's going to end up being nothing but a mess. But in fact, when you let it rise, the rising actually gives it body that it didn't have before and makes it easier to handle. Then the other thing is to let it rise, form the loaves and let them rise overnight in the refrigerator. And it turns out that process of cooling the loaf down actually redistributes the gases to some extent, and so you end up with much larger kind of aggregate bubbles when you do the baking.
And it's not going to be, it's going to cook all the way through even if it starts cold?
Well, what you do is you take the chilled loaves out of the refrigerator and let them sit at room temperature for a while, and you basically let them do their second rising on your countertop as the oven's heating. And
okay.
you can tell just from looking at them and poking at them when they're ready to go in the oven.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Have a happy holiday.
Looking forward to reading that new version.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
And that new version is called On Food and Cooking, the Science and Lore of the Kitchen. We're talking this hour with Harold McGee, who's the author, and also with Richard Zehr, who's a specialist in bubbles. We only have like less than a minute. I don't want to get into too much, so we're going to take a break, come back, and I want to explore with Richard about how he writes about how bubbles in beer, wine, they rise to the surface at different rates and why they do that. It sounded pretty complicated. Maybe we can get a thumbnail description of that from Dr. Zehr when we come back. So stay with us. We'll take more of your questions about the chemistry and physics, biology of cooking. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. This hour, we're talking with my guests, Harold McGee, author of On Food and Cooking, and Richard Zehr, professor in natural science at Stanford University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Hope you're having a good time traveling. If you're stuck on I-64, we hope that at least Science Friday may be making your day a little bit easier coping with that snow. Hope you get home safe and happy. Let's see if we can take a phone call or two. But before we do, let's talk about, well, let me take this caller in five. Evan in Hollywood, Florida. Hi, Evan.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
My question was, how long can you keep a bottle of champagne before you need to open it?
Yeah, it's lying around the house forever, right? You're waiting for that occasion, and the occasion never comes. So you move it from here to there. It rolls in the back seat of your car. You put it down in the basement. You think I have to store it in the dark? I move it up into the refrigerator.
Not quite, but
okay.
Well, it's like a good wine, and it should be able to keep for many years.
Many years. If once it's refrigerated, do you have to keep it refrigerated, or does it not matter, Richard?
I haven't found it to matter. No difference, Harold?
But I would say though that if you're living in Florida and ambient temperature is warm,
so this is true for any white wine.
Yeah, it's not going to keep as long as it would in a 55 degree cellar someplace in the north. So I would look for an excuse soon.
Yeah, I think you have one next week or two. Thanks for calling.
And as you know, wines peak. You don't want to keep them beyond a certain point in general, unless you wish to show them to your friends but not open them.
Now, you speak of champagne as a white wine. Will it peak just like, you know, like another wine would and go bad after a certain time?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Speaking of wine, you've written extensively about bubbles, and how I was reading an article of yours, Richard, about how bubbles rise differently in different kinds of beers and wines.
Well, I bet everybody's had this experience, but you may not have realized it. If you open a bottle of soda water and pour it onto a glass, the bubbles rise very rapidly to the top of the glass and pop.
Sure.
Now, do the same with champagne. They rise to the top more slowly. And now they collect a little bit. You see a little bit of foam on this champagne, but not ahead. Take now a beer. You'll find that the bubbles are rising about half as fast as they did in soda water. And moreover, you get a head. You get a foam that stays for a while. There's a big difference. Now, what's this difference? It's something we call surfactants. And these are molecules that are like soap, the organic molecules that like to actually stick to water, part of them, and the other part likes to stick to air, get out of the water. We call one part hydrophilic, that likes the water, the other part hydrophobic or greasy, that likes to get away from the water. And these surfactants are found mostly in beer, some in champagne, and hopefully not at all in soda water. And they account for a very big difference. When the bubble gets coated with these surfactants, as it does in beer, then it turns out the bubble can't clean itself. Normally, the surface of the bubble, you have an upper hemisphere and a lower hemisphere, and the upper hemisphere is always flowing into the lower hemisphere as the bubble rises, and the bubbles are self-cleaning normally, but not in beer. And as they become rigid, they actually slow down. It's much better if they're able to distort a little and slip by. And that makes them rise more rapidly. And the effect, as I tell you, is like a factor, too. It's very observable.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255. One thing before we go to the phones is something I've been wondering for years, and maybe you can explain this to us, Harold. Has anybody ever made a fruitcake? I mean, do you know anybody who's made one? Do you have a recipe? What makes a fruitcake a fruitcake? Or is it anything you can put together? I'm not sure I found one in your book.
Well, no, I don't. There are no recipes in my book except old ones. I mean, from medieval times, just for comparison. But I think what makes a fruitcake is essentially density, right? You want it to be mostly pieces of candied fruit with just enough flour to kind of hold them all together. And so it's not like your usual cake. It's not like your usual bread. There's very little air. It's very dense and very heavy, and sometimes too much so.
Lasts forever. Is that a myth? Well, you actually, I'm sure you've made a fruitcake, but have you ever known a person who's made a fruitcake?
Oh yes, yes, and in fact, lasting for a long time. You know, it used to be one of the most important things in cooking was finding ways not only to make foods edible but to make them last. And so, lots of things started out that way. I mean, pies are a kind of evolution of sort of a pastry container that used to be used to help keep meats and things like that longer than they would if they were exposed to the air. So you would bake them in this pastry casing that was very dense, and that would keep the air out for a certain amount of time and keep the meat from spoiling.
Milk and cheese would be something like that.
That's right, yeah. Cheese and wine and beer, for that matter, are all forms of what you might call limited spoilage. Mm. You let this process of degeneration take place to a certain point where the food actually reaches a kind of stability that it didn't have before, and then you can keep it and use it.
Let me go
one of my favorite things that Harold McGee taught me about is guacamole. And whether or not the pit of the avocado really is any more or less effective than putting a light bulb into a guacamole.
Light bulb? let me go to the phones. Go ahead. You want to answer that? Go ahead.
Well, why don't you say more?
Well, just, you know, I came to California about 20 years ago, and that was one of the first things I was told about food by people who live here, is that if you're going to make guacamole dip, you put the pit in the center of the bowl, and that'll keep it from turning brown. And it turns out that that's true, but only underneath the surface of the pit. And a light bulb works just as well. So
it keeps the air
away. All you're doing is keeping air away, exactly.
All we're supposed to do is put the lemon juice or something, the antioxidant.
And that slows the enzymes down, that's right.
Larry in Santa Rosa, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. A couple of years ago we had the poly pill, which was a combination of common drugs to prevent chronic illness. And then last week they came out with the poly meal. I don't know if you've heard of the poly meal.
That's a holiday dream food, isn't it?
It was really great because it's like going full circle. You know, it turns out that drinking wine and eating chocolate is the healthiest thing you can do. And I just wanted to know if your guest had any comments on that.
Well, this came out, was published in the British Medical Journal. It said if you drink red wine, you eat garlic, you take chocolate...
Fish and almonds.
And almonds. You could add
My comment
years,
is yum,
you could,
yum.
You could add years to your life was what they...
It's like thousands of scientists sitting there working for decades to figure this out. It's really hilarious.
It's the perfect holiday food. Thanks for calling, Larry.
Okay.
And happy holiday to you. Yeah, Harold, did you hear about that one at all, the poly meal?
No, it's news to me, but it's certainly something that's changed a lot. 20 years ago when I was writing the book the first time around, chocolate was not supposed to be good for you, coffee was not supposed to be good for you, wine, and now 20 years later it's like that, Woody Allen's sleeper, things that
that's right.
Were supposed to be bad for you turn out to be just fine.
Tell us anything else that has changed in the last 20 years. Actually, we're coming full circle in our conversation. I mentioned that at the beginning. What other changes have you noticed in that affect your second cookbook here on this?
Well, I mean, in general terms, the American public has just gotten much more interested in food and curious about it and interested in the details.
And a lot heavier. The public has gotten, they're interested. And the portion sizes are so much bigger than they used to be.
Yeah, that's true. Although those seem to be, now that that's become an issue, they seem to be edging back down a little bit. Mm. But and then just the range of things that are available to us these days. You know, the world has gotten so much smaller, and we can get our hands on ingredients that we could only read about before.
We're talking with Harold McGee and Richard Zehr this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Of course, we didn't have to worry about portion control for tuna fish or salmon 20 years ago with all the heavy metals and pesticides and things.
Although, you know, when I was growing up in the Midwest, I can remember the only fish we really could get that was okay was swordfish. And we had to give that up for a few years back in the 60s there was a mercury problem back then, which then was sort of explained away as, well, you know, that's just the nature of these big ocean-going fish. And it went away for a while, and now it's back as a concern.
Michael in Boston, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, very quick hypothesis. In the corked bottle of champagne, ambient air gets locked in that would otherwise be displaced by CO2 coming out of the liquid. But my question was, what is the froth that forms when you start to make stock? And you're always told that you have to remove it. You absolutely must. I'm just wondering.
Skim it off.
Yeah. Well, I would guess it would be just sort of J random proteins, and I don't think it necessarily make the stock that bad.
Well, you're right. They are proteins and mainly proteins, other stuff as well, cell debris. What I have found is that whether you skim it off or not, if you take the trouble to cook the stock gently so that you don't kind of from turbulence just kind of mix things up and emulsify things, if you cook it very gently, eventually that froth sinks. You know, it just kind of breaks apart and sinks. Either that or it forms a kind of firmer and firmer coat on the surface, and it becomes easier and easier to take off because it almost solidifies.
They used to tell people to put eggshells on the surface, if I remember, years ago. Or am I just hallucinating, Harold?
I don't know about eggshells, but you do clarify stocks by whipping egg whites into a foam and then stirring that into the stock. And then those proteins end up collecting to themselves all the other proteins that are suspended in the stock. And
this is another froth flotation, I think.
That's right. That's right.
There's another trick that I learned years ago about
separation.
About making I talked about the green in hard-boiled eggs and the dreaded green. You know, you got a big party, you make all these hard-boiled eggs. Why do the yolks turn green, and how do you prevent that?
Well, that happens because the yolks contain a lot of iron, and the whites contain a lot of sulfur. And when you mix sulfur and iron together at high enough temperatures, you end up with ferrous sulfide, which is a green substance. And that happens at the surface of the yolk because that's where those two compounds can meet. And the way you avoid that is not to overcook the eggs. It's that simple. So you just cook them for 12 or so minutes at a simmer under the boil, and then it won't be a problem.
So you make sure you put them under cold water at that 12-minute point.
That's right. You want to stop the cooking immediately. So as soon as they're done, then you pour out the hot water and replace it with cold water.
Mm-hmm. So, Richard, where is the final frontier for you on bubbles? Any new bubble research coming up?
Well, I've had a lot of fun with Dr. Andy Alexander exploring the fact that bubbles in certain drinks actually go down rather than go up.
You have that Guinness experiment.
That's right. And I've been learning myself that the nature of a bubble isn't so straightforward as you first think. You think it's just going to go straight up. But it turns out that if it gets to be a certain size, it starts to zigzag back and forth. And the bubble actually is influenced by its own wake in a very complex phenomena that's hydrodynamic.
Wow.
Bubbleology here.
So some of the bubbles
I'm still learning. I'm still a student of this. Just a hobby.
Yeah, so in a glass of Guinness, some of the bubbles are actually going up and some are going down as they sort of circulate. That way.
There's a circulation set up because it's so much easier in such froth when the beer settles for it to liquid to rise more in the center than on the sides. And the rising beer then has to spill out somewhere, and it spills out and makes a circulation that carries bubbles downwards.
There are a couple of home experiments this holiday with beer and champagne. Thank you, Richard, for joining us. Richard's a professor of natural science at Stanford University.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Happy holiday. Harold McGee, good luck with your book on food and cooking.
And thanks very much, Ira.
You're invited back anytime you'd like, both of you. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Erica Hilton, and senior producer Karen Vergoff. Charles Berquist is our director and web producer. Our engineer in Stanford is Damon Meyer. We also had help from Ryan Roberts. I want to thank all of you for spending your day off with us. If you'd like to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, we have teaching materials that we make from Science Friday, from Science Friday's Kids Connection, press on the Teachers button. Also, back editions of Science Friday you can download in your iPod or listen to them on Real Audio. Have a great weekend and a happy holiday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.